My name is Tim Power from the Latin American Center. I had the pleasure of being the director of the center in 2011 when we signed our first cooperation agreement with CAF. And this has been a signature initiative which has brought tremendous benefits to the Latin American Center. Conferences, research, visiting fellows, and student scholarships. And the LAC operates very much like Andres Rugeles. We take the gifts from CAFs and we take them over to One Church Walk and we hide them there. But actually, we reintroduced them into the world after 9 months of training at Oxford, and we're very grateful for the support you've given us for scholarships. I think the presence of the Vice Chancellor and the Warden here demonstrates is a testament to how important this relationship has been to us. We're also delighted to have the title of this conference. For many of us who've studied Latin America for a long time, we often labored under the impression that inequality and poverty in Latin America were intractable, that they were inertial, right? I labored under that impression for many years in a kind of a depressing thought about the future. But what's happened over the last 10 to 12 years has changed our impressions of what's possible in Latin America. As President Garcia has mentioned, we have causes and challenges and opportunities. He referred to the challenges. We have the short blanket effect of social inclusion. When you cover your head, you uncover your toes. As you have social inclusion in Latin America, you create other issues which need to be resolved. President Garcia pointed to one of the trade-offs, which is, should governments trade away growth to obtain social inclusion, or should they trade away social inclusion in order to obtain growth? This is one of the dilemmas that Latin America faces, as you correctly pointed out, as growth slows and the commodity boom ends. To deal with these questions, we could not have a better keynote speaker than Guillermo Perry. Guillermo Perry did his doctoral studies at MIT in the early 70s. He then went on to a distinguished career in Colombia as Minister of Mines, as a member of the Constitutional Convention of 1991, and as Minister of Finance, and then on to a very successful tenure at a period of tremendous growth for the Latin American and Caribbean program at the World Bank, where he was chief economist from 1996 to 2007. He has been a visiting professor here at Oxford and at the Kennedy School. He serves on a number of boards and is a director of the Woodrow Wilson Institute in Washington and also an advisor to the presidency of CAF. It is a distinct pleasure to introduce Guillermo Perry as our keynote speaker. Thank you.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be back here. I was here at St. Anthony's in 79. And I have to say that it has grown a lot. This building was not here, for example. We used to play squash here. The topic of this conference is a very important topic. It's a relatively new topic for us. Excuse me, can I have the... Thank you. And what I'm going to do in this introductory remarks is to give a general overview of the discussion. Many of the people that have been doing research in this area are here today with us and will be in the next panels. So I will be trying to not only summarize some of the things that they have done, but to put on the table a couple of concerns and try to be a little bit provocative for the rest of the day. Let me see how this works. Oops. I should have requested, oh, this doesn't. In this presentation, I hope to cover these 5 points. First, when I was asked to do this, and I personally have not written on the subject, my first question was, why do we care about the middle classes? What is it special about the middle classes, according to the literature, that would have us dedicate a special interest to them? The second is, as we will see, a lot of these arguments are related to the role of the middle classes for growth or for institutions, like democracy, social tolerance, and so on. But something that I want to put on the table for the discussion is that there are some competing hypotheses. I've done some work on relation of inequality and growth, and many of the arguments that are given for the role of the middle classes for growth are given in this literature for lower inequality and growth. In some other cases, what I see is that what is the concern is the concentration of the top, in the top 1%, and the negative effects of that concentration, for example, in the U.S. today, for growth and for democracy. So I think something that we need to, in future years, to do more is to try to sort this out. What channels are really channels that have to do with the, specifically with the middle classes, and which have to do with other aspects of income distribution or equality of opportunities and so on. The third is then how we do define and measure the middle class, which is not an obvious thing, and we'll dedicate a little bit to that. Then I will show, summarizing the work of many of you here, some of the characteristics that I can see of the middle classes in Latin America in particular, and contrast them to what were the assumptions in the literature in favor of the relationship of middle classes and growth and democracy, and finalize with a few suggestions. Thank you. Next. Well, looking at the history of the discussion on middle classes, one of the first writers on the subject was Aristotle. I found a couple of quotes in which he would say something like this. This is a free translation. The best political community is formed by citizens of the middle class. Those states in which the middle class is large are likely to be well administered. Where middle class is large, there are less likely to be factions and dissensions. Of course, he was talking of a very different middle class. The middle class of the classical period is not the same that we have in mind. But I think he was one of the first to suggest that the middle classes were, for some reasons, absolutely key to a good political society. That was the focus of his. I'm sorry, this is not working, and we'll have to. Then comes a very broad literature on what is, I would call the American dream. This is something.
This way.
Oh, okay. Yes. Thanks. There is a very broad literature, both scientific and more popular literature, about the fact that what has done great America in the terms of the U.S. is their middle classes. And I looked at a few examples of this literature of recent writings, like the two that I quote there, one of them of the present chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, but another one of a center that has done a lot of work on this area, the Center for American Progress. And basically, they suggest four channels through which the middle class has been absolutely key for economic development and economic growth in the U.S. The first one is human capital. According to this literature, the middle class helps the accumulation of human capital through two channels. First, they normally educate their children much more than lower classes, so they create human capital in their families. But second, it is said in all this literature that the middle class normally becomes the basic political support for the expansion and quality of public education. And let's keep this in mind, because this is an issue I want to come back when we discuss the case of Latin America. The second channel has to do with the development of the domestic market. This is put in different ways, but basically my translation of this as an economist is that there are some activities, some industrial activities in particular, or service activities, that have economies of scale and that can only develop in a country in an efficient way when there is a minimum size of demand and a stable demand for it. So, and some of the most recent models, theoretical models on this, suggest that it is not only goods that require economies of scale, but that the middle class demands goods that are more and services that are more sophisticated technologically speaking. And that because of that, they create a market for these types of goods, which have externalities and spillovers on other activities. So that would be a second channel. A third channel would be entrepreneurship. The way it is said in the US normally is the middle class is the cradle for entrepreneurship. And there is a lot of work trying to show that most of the entrepreneurs in the US come from the middle class. And finally is something that resonates with Aristotle, is the support of inclusive political and economic institutions, like democracy, property rights, a regulation that is not biased, and so on. Now, the OECD has also written a lot. I see Christian here, so I'm not going to go. The arguments are quite similar, are a little more technical, but quite similar to the previous one, so I'm not going to go into that. One of the first economists that tried to measure some of the things was Bill Easterly in 2001. And this is kind of a summary of some of his findings. And the one that I want to mention is this. He does find that that dividing countries in which the share of the middle income class is low, medium, or high, those in the high, with high shares of the middle income class, tend to grow faster than the others, especially when there is low ethnic diversity. He finds a big association between these two. Now, although this is very well done econometrically, this paper, it has a problem with the definition of the middle class that we will discuss, because it's one of those papers that defines the middle class as those in the middle. But those in the middle can be very different from country to country. I was mentioning the fact that when you look at other strands of the literature on growth, and particularly one that I have done some work in the past, which is the relation between inequality and growth, well, you do find some of the same arguments that a country with high inequality, with very high, will have a lower rate of investment. Normally, the argument there is that when you have high inequality, you have a group of the population that do not have enough wealth, and with an imperfect financial market, they cannot finance either their business ideas, their accumulation of physical capital, or of human capital. So there is a broad literature with models and trying to attempt to measure this negative effect of high inequality. And the arguments for the middle class on these two are very similar. So one of the issues here is it the middle class or is it inequality in general? Some of the other arguments, like, for example, I would think issues related to rights and to democracy, the arguments seem very strong, some of them, especially the property rights and the political rights for the middle class. I found a little less clear the arguments in general in the literature for human rights. But I find stronger arguments here for the share of the top, in the sense that it is very clear that when there is a lot of concentration, at least these people are very keen to make sure that their property is very well protected, probably not all property. And they are normally not very keen to disperse political rights and human rights to the rest. So the question is, and this is key in the present political debate in the US, because you read papers about the fact that the middle class is weakening and it is bad for democracy, and most of the arguments are really about the concentration on the top and the risks that this imposes. Obviously, one thing is related to the other. If the if there is a lot of concentration at the top, you will have less of a middle class. But it's not analytically the same argument. And this table, I can go on and on all the arguments. And there are a few arguments that have to do probably more with poverty, like these ones. I did some work some years ago with Humberto Lopez and Luis Erven, showing that the argument for inequality, high inequality and growth through these two are really more about the size of the poverty of the group of the poor. If you have a large group of the poor with no access to financial system, you have less accumulation of human capital and human investment and physical investment. And there are others that in which poverty doesn't appear at all, like here, and that inequality is more important. But one thing that I would like to leave with you is that going forward, I think it would be very important, both in the theoretical work and in the empirical work, to try to discriminate among these hypotheses that are related but are not the same. Now, let's turn to the definition and measuring of the middle class. And this is a title of... I found... Because, for example, Aristotle talked about the middle class, but he doesn't define it. At least I didn't find a definition. Marx clearly defines the middle class, and he's very derogative about the middle class. For him, the middle class is this small bourgeoisie composed of a few independent entrepreneurs, bureaucrats, and intellectuals that either play no role among the two important classes, the capitalists and the workers, or play this awful role of being agents of the bad guys. Some of the neo-Marxists give a higher role to especially Dyrendorf and Wright, because they point out that in modern society, modern capitalism, you have a set of managers and technical experts that, although they are not the owners, they do exercise control over means of production, which was the real concern of Marx on ownership. Then you have Weber. I'm not going to try to explain Weber because I have never been able to understand him well. And following, but in my own view, the definitions of Weber basically are, in the end, are focused on the issues of skills and education as the main determinants of this middle class that has different life opportunities. In several senses, economic and political. And most of the modern sociologists and political scientists actually put most of the emphasis on education. Some define it just as those with tertiary education or occupation, professional managers as here, or white collar. But a lot of this literature begin to show something that, in my view, is very, very important, which is that the positions in society of the middle class and the type of contracts that they have are contracts with much less risk than those that have other segments below. So the question of economic security and stability and opportunities begin to be very important in some of the modern social. Now, economists, we are normally obsessed with income, so most of the definitions have to do with income, either absolute ranges or relative or polarization measures, but they have to do with income distribution. Some you'll say are the middle decile, some have a range around the mean or the median, and so on. Some are absolute, but most of them, I have to say, when you read them, the ranges are rather arbitrary. It's very difficult to have a very strong rationale. The first case in which I see a very clear rationale for the definition has to do with the work of Felipe López Calva, that I think is here or was going to be here, and that was taken by the World Bank in this report that they produced a couple of years ago. Because here they take back this concept of economic security, and the definition is the middle class is not only composed by people that are out of poverty, but that have a very low probability of falling back into poverty when there are shocks. And you can do a statistical analysis of that. And they come out, they measure that in most Latin American countries, that cutoff point is around $10 a day. And by the way, there are several other papers that have used that figure without the same rationale. Now here, this is a lot of the definitions based on income. I'm not going to read them, but I'm going to show for three countries from López Calva and their colleagues what they do is they say if the history of economic shocks of the past is going to repeat in the future, as most of we do in these simulations, what are the characteristics of those that would have less than a given percentage of probability, 5 to 10%, of falling back into poverty in the next 5 years or so? And what they find is a curve like this, in which the probability is very high up to 7, 8, and becomes very low around $10 per day. So that's the way they define the cutoff point of the middle class. Now, they do not have a similar rigorous argument for defining the level of income that makes the division between middle classes and high classes and the rich, and that's something I think we have to work a little more going forward. It's interesting to compare these blue points are the share of the middle class at present in 2009, according to this World Bank López Calva definition, for the Latin American countries according to their income per capita. And you see, as you would expect, a clear correlation with income per capita. The richer the country, larger the share of the middle class. It's interesting to compare this with Latino Barometro, that another service that asks people, do you belong to the middle class? Or do you belong to the poor, to the rich? And normally, the shares, these are the points from Latino Barometro. And though there are some countries in which there is a very important correspondence, in most of them there is not. Actually, the correlation with income is almost non-existent. So in most of the countries, it's almost the same percentage of people, but with very different income levels, that claim to be middle classes. The only interesting thing here is that in all of the countries, the cutoff point is at least the $10 per day that come from the Luis Felipe Calva calculations. There are countries in which people that define themselves as middle class have at least 20 or at least $25 per day, but in those countries in which people with lower incomes define themselves as middle income classes, they almost never go below this $10 cut, so that seems to reinforce the idea. Now, let me insist a little bit on the importance of this concept of economic security. I read very carefully some of this recent work, which is work that is a mixture of academic and advocacy work for the middle classes of the Center for American Progress. And it's interesting to see that although they don't have a precise definition in numerical terms, what they say is when we say middle classes, we mean something different than just being in the middle. We say that they have enough financial security to provide investments for the next generation, one first important distinction. That has some economic security, like a good job with health insurance and retirement plan, issue related to security, some savings in the bank to tie them over in an emergency, send a child to college, or float a loan to a member that wants to start up a new business. And when they go in their detailed analysis of all the channels and show all the analytical and academic evidence for that, which there is in most of the cases, the key concept is that what makes the middle class perform in a different way than the lower classes is the fact that the sense of economic security permit them to do long-term planning, long-term investments, and risky investments, which people with lower incomes and more vulnerability and more risk of falling into poverty would not have that level of economic security to do long-term and risky investments. And that is why, in their view, the middle class is key for human capital, because for the economic security permits them to devote more time to children, to use early childhood programs, to keeping children during all the period from entering school to tertiary school, which is a lot of time and effort and expenditures. But they have the economic security to afford to do this continuous investment on their children. And once they go out, something that is very important in the recent literature is that they don't take the first job. They can afford to search for jobs, to change careers, to look for a better match. Same with domestic market development. You only begin to really invest in durables or in housing when you have some minimum economic security or consume more technologically sophisticated goods, and especially with entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship requires risking some money. You have to have some capital to risk, so you need some level of economic security to be able to devote, to let some of your family members to go into the taking the risk of becoming innovators and entrepreneurs. Now, so with this general view, let me summarize a little bit my reading of the work of many of you in this conference about. But I'm going now to concentrate on the definition of Luis Felipe Calva and the people from the World Bank for the reasons I said. First, this is a distribution of income on average in Latin America for year 2009. And according to their definition, less than $4 a day are the poverty, that is the area below this line in yellow. Below this red line would be the poverty rate. Here, this is the group that they would call the vulnerable, because they are above the poverty line but have a high probability of falling back to poverty. Here is their middle class. So the area here would be the middle class, and here would be the rich. A first thing to note is that the mode, the median, is around the vulnerable. So really, most of the population in Latin America is still there. It's not, according to this, yet in the middle class. And the second thing is that you would expect that a lot of these guys in the low middle class are a little bit different from this just by looking at this graph. And this comes out later. According to this is the recent growth of the middle class in Latin America that has aroused the interest in the middle class in Latin America. As you see, for a long period of time, according to this definition, there was not a significant an increase in the share. It was basically from 2003 onwards that there was a significant increase in the share of the middle class. And basically, it was compatible with a very strong reduction in the poverty rate. Basically, those that left poverty either went up to increase the size of the vulnerable class or the size of the middle class in particular. But according to this, the middle class is about one-third of the population at this moment in the region. It's not a majority yet, but it's a sizable chunk. Obviously, it varies by countries. This is a comparison among several emerging market countries to show the huge differences that are there. I mean, a country like Chile has nearly 40%, Brazil a little more than 30%, a country like Honduras just like 15%, Russia is high, Turkey, South Africa here. And countries like India, Indonesia, and China, just taking the urban population, because rural is very low, the middle classes, is very, very low still. Although, of course, given the huge populations, in absolute terms, it's a lot of people. But in relative terms, according to this definition, is still quite a minority in these countries. This showed the trends among Latin American countries. Chile is on the top here. This is a share of population, which we have been discussing. This is Costa Rica. I think this is Brazil here. And this is a country like Honduras below. There is an odd case of Dominican Republic that I don't know why appears to be going down while it is growing. It's a question of changes in the income distribution. And this is the share in incomes. The share in incomes is a little more than the share in populations, go from today from 40 to 60%. So in terms of the market, it's a sizable market because it's really 40 to 60% of the size of the economy. So it is a significant fact. Now, obviously, the increases in the share of the middle class, because this definition, as others, is a definition on absolute terms of income, is derived from a concept of vulnerability, but in the end, is absolute real incomes, then growth increases the share, as you would expect. And what has happened is that clearly those countries that have grown the faster, this is accumulated per capita growth during 2000 to 2010, and this is the growth of the middle class. In general, those countries in which the middle class grew more were countries in which per capita income growth grew the most. The correlation is positive. However, there are important exceptions, like Dominican Republic and Uruguay, where there were, according to this definition, reductions in the share of the middle income class, in spite of the fact that they grew, and some that were more successful, let's say, in terms of producing middle class for the level of growth. But one major issue that this graph suggests has already been mentioned by Enrique Garcia is, okay, we had this period of growth of the share of the middle class. In general, the countries that grew more were the ones in which the middle class share grew more. Now, this period of high growth is gone. And we are apparently back at best to our historical average, in which, as I showed before, the middle class share was not increasing. So a major question for the next years is if Latin America can sustain the growth of the middle class as a share of its population in a period of relatively modest growth. That, I think, is clearly a major research and political issue, as you mentioned before. Now, another thing that is interesting to look here about these trends in the past is what happened in the changes during this period of change. This is also from the World Bank book. From 1995 to 2010, the poor that were originally below $4 per day in PPP were 45% of the population. More or less half of them remained poor. Almost half became vulnerable, went to the second group. And very few made the jump directly from poverty to the middle classes during these 15 years. So it's not so easy to get out from poverty and go to the middle class in the sense of having a low probability to go back. Just in 15 years of high growth, only a very small percentage went all the way from poverty to the middle class. Of the 33% that were originally in this category of vulnerable, a little less than the half kept there, and more than half went to the middle class. So the new middle class were people that were already out of poverty, but still were vulnerable, had the possibility of going back, and now feel more economically secure. It's less likely to go back to poverty. And very few went back. This is a period of high growth in which very few went down. But this can change in a period of modest growth. Now, what is the characterization of the middle class that comes from this type of work? First, I am afraid you don't see this very well. But here, these bars are the four groups: the poor, the vulnerable, the middle class is the red, and the upper class is the pink. And these are several countries in the region. And the question is, if the middle class looks very different than the classes below, and you see here, this is the level of education of the average family in these categories, and you do see a significant, in most countries, a significant jump from the poor and the vulnerable to the middle class. Of course, there is still another jump from the middle to the rich. But clearly, in most countries, the level of education distinguishes the middle class. And this is consistent with the view before that if the middle class has more economic security, can plan long-term and do long-term investments in education, which the previous, the vulnerable and the poor cannot do. And this is also consistent with the idea that one of the ways in which the middle class can contribute to grow is because the middle classes accumulate more human capital. So this is consistent with that. This is to show that in some countries, the middle class is definitely more urban than the poor and the vulnerable, especially in poorer countries like Honduras. In richer countries like Chile and Brazil, the difference is not very much. Everybody is urban, basically. Okay. Migration makes a difference in some countries, but not in others. But here comes another issue that apparently tells apart the Latin American middle classes from this general view or what I call the dream of the middle class, which is that the middle classes in most of the countries, here the middle class, here you have a division between the low middle class and the higher group. I show you that there were basically this is the middle class, sorry, the 10 to 15. It's, you see a huge jump here in almost every country, and this is the percentage of students that go to private schools. So what this shows is that in Latin America, the middle class defined in this way tries to take their children to private schools. It's not only the rich. It's a very big percentage of the emerging middle classes. If this is true, then the middle class in Latin America is not going to be a major source of political support for public education. And it's a question mark that is quite important for the region, because we have a region in which the quality of education is very low. Coverage was relatively low until three decades ago. It has improved a lot. And our reason historically for that was that the rich always opted out of the public education system, used private education, so they didn't care about public education, and they were the one with power. So they never cared to create a strong public education system in Latin America. And now, if the hopes are that this emerging class is going to be the source of political support, this figure puts a doubt on that, a major question mark, which I think it would be important to discuss. Another issue that I want to show here is there are some occupations that change across the income scale very strongly, but in which you don't see big jumps from going to the vulnerable to the middle class. For example, people employed in primary activities are mostly poor or vulnerable. This is primary activities in different countries. The middle class has very low participation in the primary production. This is a fact, an interesting fact. On public employment, it is a continuum. You cannot say that there is a big break when you go from the vulnerable to middle class. In Costa Rica, there is, but not in the others. It's a continuum. Across the income scale, as people grow richer, go more to public office, in a way. And this is what is a concern. The amount of employers, we don't have a good figure of entrepreneurs, so we have here to use employers as synonymous for entrepreneurs, and allow me to do that because obviously this is not precise. But it's an indication. You will not be an entrepreneur if you're not an employer. So only a part of these are real entrepreneurs. And this figure look very, very small in most countries. And these figures do not look very different from the previous groups. So in Latin America, most of the entrepreneurs come from the rich classes, do not come from the middle income classes. So at least there appear to be two channels of the literature on middle class and growth, the channel of support, political support for public education, and the cradle of entrepreneurship that do not seem to be true in the case of Latin America. These obviously are purely indicative figures, and these are issues that I think and would suggest that require more research because are going to be very important. Another issue that normally the literature in the US and Europe do not talk much about, but that is very important in Latin America, is the women's participation in the labor force. And here you can see that in several countries, there is a big jump from going from poor to vulnerable, and again from vulnerable to middle class in the share of women in the... And I personally think this is a major factor of the modernization of Latin American societies in every respect. It has been responsible for a lot of the growth because it has been an increase in the labor force, but especially about a society with somehow more tolerance and less discrimination and so on. Now, to finalize, a key question about what we did, we began with what Aristotle was saying about the enormous political virtues of the middle class. And you can superimpose this, and some people have done it. Luis Felipe just arrived. I have been using extensively your work here, saying very bad things about it, as you will hear. And with these opinion polls in which people are asked value questions. And, before that, I have to say that one of the few that have tried to measure this in a different way is really Bill Easterly in his papers. He tried to look, he said, well, if it is true that we would expect that the middle classes are strong political support for things like public education and public health, according to the American literature, then having a panel regression among countries on growth rates, controlling for other things, if you plug in the share of the middle class, those countries with a larger middle class should have higher levels of education and public health. And what he finds, but I already said that his definition of middle class is not the best, but the type of exercise is interesting of what can be done going forward. He doesn't find a significant effect on education. He finds an effect on health, on roads and sanitation, he also finds support financial debt, apparently, and significant support for political rights. Here the index is the opposite, but not for civil liberties. This is an interesting finding. With all the problems of definitions that Bill Easterly has, but it's the only, I think, very carefully done econometric work on this aspect. And a lot of support for stability, for political stability. Less revolutions, constitutional changes, and so on. This is not measured by the attitudes of people, but by the results of the country that have a higher share of the middle class, according to his definition, controlled by other things. Now, this is the one that I was mentioning, showing, matching the opinions in Latino Barometer and other surveys with this classification of Luis Felipe and his colleagues. And what it shows is that going from the vulnerable to the lower middle, you don't find significant changes in here, less something that is called interpersonal alienation, but not so much in the political aspects. Going from the lower middle to the upper middle, there is some increase in the trust of institutions. There is some significant reduction in political alienation, strange reduction in nationalism, and increase in interpersonal trust. So the picture that comes out from here, in a paper that Luis Felipe and his co-authors have on this, they basically say we do not find middle-class exceptionalism in terms of values. I think this has to be, my reading is a little bit more nuanced. There is some, especially when you go to the upper middle class, there are some changes in terms of trust in institutions, interpersonal trust, but in a few other things, like social tolerance and alienation, but they are not huge. Yes, I'm finished. Now, that work also shows that if you put a dummy for country, not only a dummy for the share of the middle class, but the dummy for country, the dummies for countries are, in general, much more significant. So their own their conclusion, and I think they are right on this, is for some reason in Latin America, values about political rights and institutions and civil liberties and that and trust seem to vary more from country to country than from lower classes to middle class. So in that sense, we cannot be sure that the middle class in every country is going to be a major supporter for better political institutions. In some, yes. In some, not necessarily. That's what I read from this. So to summarize, because the time is short now, first, I said that I think it's very important, this contribution that Luis Felipe and his colleagues have done of having an objective measure for the lower cutoff point for the middle class. And it is particularly important that it is related to economic security, because I did show at the beginning that most of the literature, of the sociological and political literature before, stressed the issue of economic security as a key difference between the middle class and other classes. So I think you did a great contribution on that. But the cutoff point between the middle class and the rich remains very arbitrary. And this is something that I think research has to work more. Let me talk first about this. The second point, to summarize, that I put on the table is that many of the hypotheses of why the middle class should be important for economic growth, the channels, the theoretical channels through which the middle class should contribute to economic growth or to political stability or development, in some other strands of the literature, you find almost the same arguments, but not for the share of the middle class, but for the level of inequality or for the concentration at the top. In some cases, the arguments are clearly more, when you look at them objectively, the arguments are more for the share of the poor or for the share of the top. In some others, they are clearly about the human middle class. But in terms of empirical work, I think it would be important to try to begin to differentiate this a little bit, although obviously these measures are correlated, so that is not an easy task to do. And the other two points that I think are intriguing about the findings is, number one, the fact that apparently most of the middle class in Latin America tend to send their children to private schools. So although they do invest more in education of their children, which will increase the human capital of the country and growth, it it is not an assurance that they will be supporting the expansion and the quality of the public education system, and thus not necessarily improving education for all. But for the class, yes, but not necessarily for all. And the second concern that comes from these figures is that although it does seem true that the middle class seem to care a little bit more about political rights, and those can be a strong support for democracy, they do not seem to care more about civil rights, civil liberties, and human rights. So it may be naive to expect that the growth of the middle class is going to come with... And anecdotically, you see it very clearly every day. We don't see the middle class as a very strong supporter of gay rights or minority ethnic groups or whatever. They tend to be a relatively conservative class in those respects. Now, issues that would be interesting to look at a little bit more than they have been looked are these two. To what extent does this middle class, defining the ways to do, in at least in their answers to the opinion polls, seem to support more macro stability or pro-market policies? I would urge you to do estimates like the ones that Bill Easterly did, but with the definition of the middle class of the World Bank. And also using, so with objective figures, but also with the subjective, because I think this might be very important. It might be true that the middle class is a strong support for macro stability and for market policies. It may not. It would be important to. And the other thing is that we are now having panel household surveys in some countries in the region in which we can follow the same family over time. It would be very interesting to see if over time, as the age composition of households change, the values change within classes, or when they cross the boundaries from one class to another. These issues are still issues that I think we don't know enough, and we would like to have some more research on them. So with this, I finish, and many thanks.